Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Manic Episodes.
Welcome.
I'm Mary Lambert.
I'm your mom's friend.
This is perfect. We're so glad y'all are here.
Thank you for joining us this evening, this morning, this afternoon.
All of it. Every time of day, we're glad you're here. And we just kind of wanted to start out this episode by saying we have a few announcements to make.
Yes, just a few minor housekeeping matters, you know, that we need to make sure that y'all are aware of.
Yeah, we've hired some new team members, so we kind of wanted to just shout them out, you know, and just really like say and you know a few congratulations. And you know, first of all, we want to say that you know, these positions aren't paid,
and they're definitely not paid,
and they require about 200 hours a month.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean,
so
it's an internship.
It's very difficult, and
it's
so
an unpaid internship, sure,
right? So,
but you'll get so much experience.
Yes,
that will probably not be applicable anywhere else, but you'll be so glad you did it. You might not be glad you did it, but yeah, you will have done it.
I think you'll probably deeply regret it.
It'll be part of your story,
and that builds character.
So I'd like to announce the first position, if I could.
Oh, yes.
Michael F. is the new Secretary of the Treasurer. That's right. His whole job is standing over our pile of treasure. You know our pile of treasure.
Yes.
And rubbing his hands together menacingly. That's perfect, right?
That's incredible.
What's your first position?
missionary.
I guess that probably is like the original position.
I don't know.
No?
Maybe.
What do you think? What is the original position?
I think God's position is doggy style.
Oh my God! That's definitely, that's sinful.
No, it's not.
Okay, go ahead and read your thing.
We're really excited to announce that Rivki is going.
You're too close to the mic. Just kidding.
You just want to undermine me. You want me to, you didn't like that I said doggy style on this podcast.
I just
want
to be in control. Go ahead.
We're excited to announce that Rivki is going to be the official soup master for the Manic Episodes.
We have needed one desperately.
The soup master makes sure we've always got soup and that the soup is hot. And
thank God.
Thank you, Rivki, for doing that. For
the worst part of recording this podcast was the cold soup.
It's the worst.
It was awful.
It's hard.
We're delighted to announce that we've created a new position for Tamara D. Like most organizations, we are absolutely desperate for new staff. It's a rough world out there for hirers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we were willing to do just about anything to bring Tamara D on board.
Yes, it's true. Yeah.
By the way, what's that company that sponsors all the podcasts? ZipRecruiter?
Yeah.
Shout out. No shout out because no free ads. Mm-hmm. Get a hold. You really fucked up not advertising on our podcast.
Jesus. Okay.
This would have been the perfect spot.
Yes, it's true.
Well, we did it. Tamara is now the curator of my personal troll doll collection. From brushing their hair to writing personal biographies for each troll to organizing them on shelves, Tamara is going to make very important contributions to the team.
That's perfect.
Isn't it great to have her on board?
That's so great. Oh, thank you.
Join me in welcoming her to the team.
Thank you, Tamara. Welcome to the team. We would also like to congratulate Katie B as our new lead paraglider.
Heyo!
She will be leading our Manic Fam paragliding excursions, which will be launching in 2035.
Ah, that's so wonderful to hear.
Yes, and it's just good. I mean, we need to keep her at about 200 hours a month at no pay for, you know, for this whole time. It just takes a lot to set paragliding excursions up.
Right. Oh, I mean, it's just usually just such a hassle. It's like some of the overhead costs that you have to really just circle back and put a pin in.
And the merging and the confluence of the synergy is going.
Absolutely.
With the, and particularly the statistician.
Statistician.
And the
statistician.
And the estheticians.
Statistician was a Renaissance painter?
Yeah.
I don't fucking know.
I think so.
I'm sorry, I can't hire
you. Oh, yeah, you're done.
I think you've got the last employee.
Well, last but certainly not least, I'll say this. Christy C. is a crucial part of our team. Much like Secretary of Treasury.
Secretary of Treasure.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you've heard of a goaltender, but Christy C. has the coveted position of being our gold tender.
Oh, our tender gold.
Totally in charge of all of our gold, and we have a lot in our gold hole.
All our tenderness. Our gold hole. That's the treasure.
Yeah.
I'm really glad we could find some points of cohesion together, you know?
Yes.
Well, we have a fabulous guest today.
Oh, my God.
And also, those are people who support us on Patreon, so thanks. Y'all keep the wheels of the podcast turning and churning, because this is a real pain in the ass to record. Pain in the ass. And if y'all didn't support us, to be honest with you, I would hang them up, and I would never record another podcast again. manic episodes, no. Patreon.com/manic episodes.
Good, honey.
Okay, yes. Will you do us the honor of introducing our guest?
Oh, my God. I cannot believe she's here.
She's not here, honey.
She's here.
No.
She's here.
Oh, okay. Hi, Judith. Hold on just one second. This is really deceptive, and I can't be part of it.
We are. We're recording this separately, and I was trying to play it off, and now I feel like you blew up my spot.
It's just real. The fact that you're willing to lie to people like that is really fucked up.
Okay, noted. Noted. I guess we're just going to be really, 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 really honest here. We'd just like to announce Judith Matz, LCSW. What does that stand for?
I think licensed clinical social worker?
Yeah.
Is that it, really?
Yeah.
Well, let me double check. Yes, it is. Licensed clinical social worker.
That's perfect. Okay. Great. Yeah, Judith Matz, LCSW, is a therapist and nationally recognized speaker on the topics of diet culture, binge eating, emotional eating, body image, and weight stigma. She's the co-author of the Making Peace with Food card deck, the Body Positivity card deck, the Diet Survivor's Handbook, and Beyond a Shadow of a Diet, and author of the children's book Amanda's Big Dream. Her work has been featured in the media, including NPR, The New York Times, Good Housekeeping, and Psychotherapy Networker. Judith has a private practice in the Chicago area.
Woo! Hell yeah!
Oh my God, so cool.
This is a good conversation, no?
Yes.
And I think that people are really going to like it and enjoy her perspective.
Yes, absolutely. I always lose my mind that, like, I can't believe I'm talking to Judith Matz. Like, it just makes me really happy because I just think she's such a force of good in this world.
And she feels the same way about you.
I know. It's very mutual.
All right, y'all. Enjoy the conversation.
Okay. We're here with Judith. Hi, Judith.
Hi, Mary. Hi, Wyatt. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. We are so honored.
Yeah, I feel very, very lucky, very privileged. Judith, you have done a few Q&As with my workshop people, and I always ask their questions, and I get upset because I don't get to ask my own questions. So if you can see, it's like I have so many questions.
You're like, when is my turn, guys?
It's my turn to talk to Judith.
Today is your turn.
Yes.
I can't wait to hear them.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, what you would want people to know about what you do.
Sure. I mean, actually, I'm just going to say a little bit about how I connected with you, Mary.
Yeah, yeah.
Mary, I first knew of your work, like, I don't know how many years it was ago, that you were performing at South by Southwest on the rooftop of Whole Foods. And my husband goes to South by Southwest, and I just kind of went along for the ride one year, not officially, but some concerts were available to everybody. And you were singing Body Love. And I've been doing this work for a really, really long time. I started like in the late 1980s. I'm a social worker, and I got training in eating disorders, what are originally the ones we thought of, anorexia and bulimia. But when I was working in eating disorders, I started a small part-time practice. I was doing some advanced training in them, and I got a job with the OptiFast program. Do you know what the OptiFast program is?
Yes, the NASA.
Life looking like what? Think Oprah Winfrey in the like late 80s, early 90s, when she lost a ton of weight. These are medically supervised fasting programs. Mm. And I was actually, I'm sorry to say now, and I apologize to anybody who I worked with, but I was working with one because I believed weight loss was a good thing. Mm. And this was a program, a medically supervised program to help people, you know, lose a lot of weight by drinking these horrible tasting shakes for 3 months, no other food, and then over time being reintroduced to it. Well, needless to say, everybody gained back the weight, and not only did I come to see everybody gain back the weight, but then I was introduced to a non-diet approach, is what we called it back in the late 80s, early 90s. And when I learned about it, not only did it make sense for me professionally, because I saw the failure of diets. I saw people were going along doing what they were told to do and it didn't work. But I'd also had some early experience of my own dieting and had quit on my own. I had known to quit. I was like, well, if I did that for myself, how do I integrate that into my professional work? So I'd been doing it for quite a while when I saw you sing, and I had this idea that, like, oh my gosh, wouldn't it be awesome to collaborate with Mary Lambert and do something around body image and body positivity at a conference like South by Southwest? But I don't remember how I tried to reach out to you. Maybe you had a website or something. Like, not surprisingly, I never heard back. And so fast forward, a lot of years later, one day I look on my Instagram and you're following me. And I was so excited. And then probably a week later, I always forget to look at my spam email, but I did. And there was a whole email from you. And so I was thrilled. And we've since obviously connected. And I've loved showing up at your workshop from time to time.
Thank you, Judith. Yeah, I'm not sure what happened, but I know, like, around that time, things were so bonkers. And I also had, I think I had a lot of fears about, like, connecting with people. And like I had dealt with stalkers and was just like, I need my team to protect me. And not, I don't want to, I'm not ready to like, to go past my comfort zone, you know?
Well, also were you, I mean, I know that because of, I know the Body Love exists, you've been interested in this for a long time, but you had not quite gone down the rabbit hole of being super interested in anti-fat bias in medicine, right?
Yes.
It was kind of new to you then?
Yes. Yeah. I hadn't really, it hadn't occurred to me to be like what all of this entailed, like all of the structures and like social structures and cultural structures and institutions that really perpetuate anti-fat bias. And like, to me, it always just seemed as like, oh, this is something people have to individually deal with, and it's their sort of responsibility to love themselves, you know, and like, and why.
Right. So that's what we typically think about, like, with body image. And that's how I taught it for a long time, too. And actually, I don't want to throw that all out the window. Like, there are still ways for people individually to work on taking care of their bodies, feeling like they deserve to have clothes that fit them at their current size, stopping the weighing. Like, there are behaviors and, you know, that really do foster feeling more at home in your body. It's just that if we see it only as an individual issue, like, you should come accomplish this on your own. And if you're not loving your body or feeling more at home in your body, it's your failure. You know, we really need to embrace that there, like you're saying, there are all of these institutions out there that promote weight stigma. And no matter how much you work on feeling at home in your body, you still have to deal with those microaggressions or actual stigma or even violence against larger bodies.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's difficult because it's so much more nuanced than a really, you know, black and white, like, absolute issue. And that, like, there are choices, certain choices that we make and certain ways we sort of perpetuate our own internalized fat phobia as well, you know. And I think it's that, and that's what I try to do in the workshop too, is like this sort of the analysis of like the cultural in the institutions that perpetuate this harm. And also, like, well, we're here, so like we have to survive. Like, we have, how do we thrive? Like, what choices can we make in order to like to feel good? Like, that is, at the end of the day, like, I just want people to feel better than diet culture has made them feel, you know.
And I think so key to that, like, to me, the insidious part on an individual level is the shame people feel.
Yes.
Right? The body shame. And so there's that sense of, like, you know, my body's not the right body. I have the wrong body in this culture. So I'll do what diet culture tells me, and I'll go on a diet and I'll lose the weight. Mm-hmm. And then that inevitably fails for just about everybody. And then there's shame about that failure, and that shame just gets so internalized. And so I think what's important in the work I do, in the work that you're doing through these workshops, is like helping people let go of the shame, right? Mm-hmm. Helping people understand how they've internalized the weight stigma and the culture. Like, you know, if you think of babies, they're not born hating their bodies. They love their bodies. They play with their fingers and their toes and they run and they skip. And this is just taught to people as they grow up from, you know, you think of like cartoons and commercials and pediatricians can be the worst. And, but even what parents are saying, even, you know, a mom looking in the window and in the mirror and saying, oh, these jeans are too tight, you know, or, you know, a parent talking about so-and-so gained so much weight, all of these messages get internalized and that becomes that shame. So I think like a class like yours, Mary, when you're getting people together and you're talking about it out loud, it really helps empower people to let go of that shame.
Thank you, Judith. I appreciate you saying that. And I just so value the work that you've done in pushing this forward and also just being a real like leader in this work as well. Like the Diet Survivors Handbook came out, like, when did that come out? In the 90s?
not quite that long ago. Early on. But it was 2006.
That's really early.
Well, actually, before the Diet Survivors Handbook, we published, so as when I say we, I'll tell you who I mean by we, but the first book was actually Beyond a Shadow of a Diet in 2004, which was meant for mental health professionals, but it's written in a way that's not too academic. And so it's really before the other book was out, it's what was used. Like therapists were giving it to their clients. My co-author, Ellen Frankel, I don't know if you know this, but she is also my sister.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So Ellen is a few years younger than me, but she was doing this work before me. She was doing this work, the anti-diet work, when I was still working at Optifast. And we would have these arguments because my dad was higher weight and I'd be trying to get him to diet. And she'd be like, leave him alone.
Wow. Early adopter. It sounds like y'all were real like pioneers, trailblazers in this area.
You know, I guess that's a yes for people who are younger, and people came before us. Really, so my work was most influenced by two New York therapists, Jane Hirschman and Carol Munter, who wrote a book called Overcoming Overeating. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that, Mary? You're shaking your head. Yeah. Yes. And then they wrote When Women Stop Hating Their Bodies. Mm-hmm. And so way, way back in the early 90s, myself and another therapist here named Carol Granick, we became their Chicago center. We connected with them, became their Chicago center. And we used to do a newsletter, like before there was social media and this was before there was the internet.
Right.
And so we literally literally had to pay to mail all these newsletters out every month. So, So I've been doing it a really long time and there are people who came before me that I learned.
You brought up something just previously, but I've been thinking about like the demonization of like weight gain, both like medically and like culturally, and about the effect that has on like growing kids. And I remember that feeling of being, you know, 8 years old, 9 years old and being like, oh my God, the scale is going up. Like every time I step on the scale, it like, it's higher and higher, and that this is bad, you know?
Yeah.
Like wondering what do you think is sort of the antidote to this, you know, or what would you tell parents?
Well, the antidote is to reject diet culture in your own home. I mean, because the thing is like, sadly, we can't completely protect kids from this. I mean, they're going to hear it from their friends at school. Unfortunately, even from teachers, sometimes it's like, you know, you can't bring brownies or cupcakes for a snack. They have to be super healthy. Like there's so many ways it gets taught. Mm-hmm. But I think that what parents can try to do is raise resilient kids. Mm-hmm. So that even if kids get caught in it, they have something to go back to. So first of all, I think on the positive side, what parents can do is, and again, this, of course, depends on like socioeconomic status and access to food, fresh foods and all of that. Like not everybody has everything they might want to offer their kids. But to offer kids a wide range of food and not rank foods or talk about foods as good and bad. Mm-hmm. So instead of thinking about kids only eating healthy foods, because parents are often concerned about healthy foods, and it's important for kids to have healthful foods. But ultimately, the goal is to have a healthy relationship with food, right? Where there's room for all of it. Help kids stay connected. Oh, your tummy's hungry, you know, to hunger. Oh, you stopped eating. Are you, you know, are you full? That's important for all of us, right? To eat when we're hungry, to eat something that will satisfy us.
And we were just talking. Sorry, Judith, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No,
sorry.
Go ahead. No.
We were just talking the other night about that, you know, that really insidious practice that is, you know, it seems like just about universal people I talk to, of having their parents say, you can't leave the table until you've finished all your food. And things like that, where I'm like, that just cannot possibly help to foster a healthy relationship with your own hunger, right?
Right, exactly. Was that your experience growing up, Wyatt? I mean, did you have that at all?
Only maybe a couple of times, but I think Mary talked about nights where she would, you know, sit in front at the dining room table until well into the night.
I was like, I'm not hungry. And I was like, I don't want dessert or anything. I want to be done.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's so like, it's really quite amazing that babies are born knowing when they're hungry and when they're full. Right. I mean, we're born knowing how to do this. Mm-hmm. And so many things interfere, but that's one of them. Like, you can't leave the table. And often in those families where you can't leave the table till you're full, and then a child's gaining weight, and it's like you're eating too much. I mean, there's just such a disconnect around how food even gets talked about, you know? Right. So I do think, like, helping support kids in staying connected to their natural hunger cues is really key. But then also, you know, for all of us, exploring our own anti-fat bias, because there is no way to grow up in this culture and not have developed it. So we all have to unlearn it.
Right.
And, you know, I think what's so hard, like, I just don't want to blame parents and especially moms, because in one way, like, what happens so often is that they've been taught, right? I mean, they've grown up feeling shame about their body. And so actually from a place of love, they don't want their kids to have to go through it and feel bad about their body. So, you know, don't eat those things because you don't want to get fat, because you don't want to feel the way I did. And then they don't understand how then, sadly, they're complicit in creating the very types of restrictive eating patterns that then lead people to want, you know, we want what we can't have. The foods you say I'm not supposed to eat are going to be the foods that glitter for you.
Right. Totally.
So when I have three kids, when my kids were younger, like I remember one of my kids had a friend where he was very restricted at home. You know, you could only eat healthy food. And when he came over, I would see him. I have a love Dove chocolates. We always had a lot of stuff around, but I'd see him taking those Dove chocolates and putting them in his pocket. And I didn't mind. I mean, I don't care, you know, but you could see how the restriction at home leads to, I better get it while I can. And just, you know, more recently with clients I've had a couple talk lately, they're young adults, about how at home, like, I'm seeing this more than like when I grew up. They grew up with only healthy foods in the house. Everything has to be organic and healthy. And, you know, maybe on a special occasion, there's birthday cake or whatever, but mostly it's always healthy. And so one talked about going to her friend's house. And when the mom put out snacks that were more what you think of snacks after school, there could be cookies or chips or what, could not stop. Like, she was binging in front of her friend and felt embarrassed. And the other client told me, I wouldn't have been friends with these kids, some of them, if they didn't have such good food, but it was the only way I could get the food.
Oh, wow.
So it, yeah.
That's completely my experience. Like, but I think for some people it can stem from, like, you know, restrictive food, but I think also for kids like me who grew up with food insecurity, there's also that, like, yes. I mean, I just, like, going and being like, oh my god, where's the food? to, like,
you were hungry.
Yeah, totally. Being I was always, like, so excited when I, like, made friends with a rich kid. I'd be like, oh my god, I bet you're gonna have Snickers in your house.
Full size Snickers.
Yeah. And it makes sense, right? I mean, of course. Like, that's protective. You were taking care of yourself.
Totally.
I hope you don't feel bad about that.
Yeah. And I think that that's sort of another part of this work, and a big element of this is that, you know, you blew open my mind last year when we started talking about, you know, people attribute, you know, behaviors when they're really just talking about the characteristic of being fat, you know? And that just, like, I don't know why I hadn't even considered that, like,
idea that weight is a characteristic, not a behavior. And so people can the idea of, like, it's more important you know, especially like when I'm working with people, like, you know, if you have a disordered relationship with food, let's work on it so that you feel at peace with food, right? So that you're not binging or restricting, you know, but that doesn't say anything about where weight will land, right? Right. Weight's just a characteristic. Mm-hmm. And so moving away from this idea that somehow a person's body size is reflective of how they take care of themselves, you really can't tell anything about a person's physical or mental health just by looking at their body. All you can really tell is, Marilyn Wan, who's a fat activist, says, all you can tell is the degree of your own bias or your own prejudice.
Ooh, isn't that true? Reach those conclusions. Culturally, we're also very good at like seeing, you know, these normative characteristics or these sort of like hegemonic characteristics, like being, you know, able-bodied or white or straight or cisgender or, you know, like, or straight sized or whatever. We see those as, it's like there's these categories that are morally neutral. That's how I always think of it. And like growing up queer, it was like my relationships I knew would not be seen. This has of course changed a lot now, but like growing up, I was like, if I'm romantically involved with someone, I am not granted that same degree of my behavior being seen as morally neutral. It's going to be loaded for people one way or the other. And, you know, I sometimes reflect and I'm like, it's amazing that I have as healthy a relationship as I do with romantic love, given the fact that not only was I queer, but, you know, I grew up around like multiple divorces between my parents and like, I didn't have good examples, but I think that's sort of what it's reminding me of is like, if you're in a marginalized position or in a marginalized body and you absorb all of those judgments about yourself, like, well, no wonder you emerge into the world, like struggling to maintain your own like equilibrium with your own desires. It's just really, it's just sad. That's how when I overhear the conversation sometimes that you'll have with people like Judith, where I'm like, I know there's reasons for hope, but it feels so heavy. It's like the amount of messaging that you get, you know, imagine like by noon, the number of messages that you've gotten about your body. Right?
Yes. Yes. The other thing too, like, I think you bring up such a, like a valuable point that it's really framed around morality for sure. That like, the pursuit of thinness is to be, you know, chaste and pure.
Absolutely.
You know? But also this, as we're talking about like the cultural perception of people in higher weights, that there's also the internal position that you feel as a fat person, that your fatness or your body size is intrinsically tied to your behavior. And so that's where I think for people, it's not just people's perception of you, it's your self-perception as well, that I have failed, you know?
Yeah. So I just want to, a couple comments about all of that. What you're talking about, why also when it comes to weight, because people, it's a marginalized identity, fat, but people see it in their control. Yes. And so you can understand why people pursue weight loss, because if I can lose the weight, I can escape the marginalized identity. And so, and then Mary, what you're talking about, this is to me like just the epitome of how horrible diet culture is. So you're saying like you feel shame around being fat, or you did.
I did, yeah.
And so you did. We're going to put that in past tense. And so you diet to lose the weight, right? To escape the shame. Mm-hmm. And then that diet inevitably fails because I assume people who are listening knows this, but upwards of 95% of people who will go on a diet will gain back the weight. Mm-hmm. And 1/3 to 2/3 end up higher than their pre-diet weight, mm-hmm. right? And so here you've done exactly what diet culture has told you to do. You've gone on a diet because it's considered morally preferable to be thin, but you make yourself fatter over time. And this is nothing to do with fat itself and thinking there's anything wrong with being at a higher size. It's just that people are dieting up to weights that are higher than where they naturally would have been if they never started dieting in the first place. So when your doctor is saying, you know, lose weight to be healthy, like, we know that if you go on a diet to lose weight, you're going to end up heavier, not thinner. And we know that weight cycling in and of itself worsens health.
Right.
As opposed to being at a higher steady weight. So it's like, It's really unethical that weight loss is being prescribed after decades and decades, going back to the early 1940s. We've known that nothing works.
Right. Totally. What do you think about, I feel like there's this push from not just, you know, Noom or Weight Watchers or, you know, these larger companies, but also pharmaceuticals to say, listen, we know it's not your fault that you're fat. Fat shaming is really bad. Here's this pill, this, or this appetite suppressant, or, you know, Novo Nordisk, the new thing that they're pushing. But like,
exactly. You know,
That is so cynical.
That is like, it is a disease and it is not your fault. Here's this pill.
In general, diets are getting more scientific sounding, but this tactic that the pharmaceutical companies are taking, Mary, you're exactly right. It's not your fault. It's a disease. And now that it's a disease, we have the medicine to solve it. And it's a way for them to make a lot of money. And I won't remember exact statistics on this, but the cost of that drug, that new one that's being pushed, you have to stay on it to keep the weight loss. If you go off it, you gain it back. And it's, you know, you start that when you're young. The monthly cost is, I'm sorry that I don't remember, and I don't want to throw out numbers and then and be wrong, but it's not nothing. It's expensive. And so, yeah, I see the look on Mary's face.
Yes, I'm so angry.
Yeah. And, you know, this drug, I mean, there have been other drugs before. There have been drugs. There was a really good book. This goes back, I think, maybe to the early 90s, but I know we talked about it in Beyond a Shadow of a Diet. I think it was called Dispensing with the Truth, about how if you make obesity a disease, then you can charge people all kinds of money. And Mary, you probably know this, Wyatt, I don't know if you do, but in 2013, the American Medical Association declared obesity a disease against the advice of their own scientific advisory board.
I had no idea that it was that recent.
2013.
That's like yesterday.
Yeah.
Well, but what it means, I mean, here's the part. What it means is that if anybody has a BMI above a certain amount, you're considered to be diseased, no matter, even if all your markers are perfectly fine.
Right.
So you can't escape the stigma. That's the problem. You can't get out from under the stigma that there's something wrong with your body. Your body is sick.
And even it's so cynical just to know that is, I mean, that has to be an example of, particularly if it was against the advice of scientists, that has
their
to be
own, their own scientific important. Advisory committee. Yeah.
Crazy. My Lord.
Yeah. I mean, what, like, I think, what do you say to people who are like, this is something I just run into so much, and I don't, like, you can't talk someone out of like where they're at and what their desires are. Like, our desires don't really change overnight. And so I feel like really difficult to, like, I imagine you experience this too, to like sort of therapize someone out of their desire to be thin, you know, and especially I know I did this too, that my desire for thinness did not, it chameleoned itself into like a desire to be healthy, you know, or like I'm going to pursue weight loss to be healthy.
Right. Right. Well, and that's, you know, so like dieting, diet culture and dieting, we have to just understand that wellness is part of that. And nothing against pursuing wellness. I mean, I think, you know, we all deserve to take care of our bodies the way that we want. But a lot of time, those wellness programs are still about weight loss. They're just, people know diets don't work. So no, I'm not dieting. I'm just trying to be healthy, right? I'm just trying to live my best life. But if the goal is to change your body shape or size, if it's to lose weight, it's a diet in disguise and it's subject to all the same pitfalls. Mary, I assume people listening to you, you've probably talked about this before, but what finally shifted it for you? Were you like really totally let go of having to change your body for weight loss? If you have, I mean, it's insidious. Yeah. It can get in there.
No. I think, you know, I stopped dieting. It's been a really gradual process for me, starting to when I was like 20, and the real setting off point for me was my friend had a magnet on her fridge that said riots, not diets. And I was just like, what? Like,
and that's to you. Okay.
Like, you cannot possibly, like, if you're in a bigger body, your job is to be in the pursuit of being smaller. Like, that's your job. Mm. Like, what are you doing? You're rejecting that? Are you okay? Mm-hmm. Like you must love yourself.
I mean, that's a great example of like how just being exposed to another idea made a big difference. And in the work I do as a therapist, people are coming to me because they want to feel at peace with food. I mean, they usually still want to lose weight, even though they know I'm not a diet program or weight loss program. They still want to lose weight, but they feel desperate because their eating feels out of control. And I always find it easier to help people with the making peace with food part, like starting to end restrictions and think about what will satisfy me. And I think a lot of times people have the fantasy, when I stop, eating out of control or discomfort, I'll be eating less and then I'll lose weight. So I think that's in the back of a lot of people's minds. Right. And some people might, if people lose weight when they make peace with food, I think of it as a side effect, not the main event. Some people may stay the same. Some people may gain weight because they come in restricting and they're under where their body is meant to be. But I think as people find that, from my experience with clients, is that as they find that peace with food, even as they're still struggling with feeling more at home in their body, they do not want to go back to dieting. They understand that it just doesn't work, that they could try again. They could absolutely lose weight because all diets work in the short run. But they know the foods are going to start to glitter again, and sooner or later they'll be out of control. And a lot of them can look back at pictures and say, I started dieting when I was a teen. I was fine.
Right.
And here I've been dieting all these years. I'm heavier than I've ever been, and I get it. The more I diet, it's just not going to work. And so then they have to do the very hard work. It's really hard. And I'll just acknowledge my own thin privilege. I'm a thinner person, and I haven't had to do the work that I'm asking my clients to do, which is to find ways to feel more at home in their bodies, given the weight stigma that's out there. And what I find is a lot of people can feel at home in their bodies in their own home. Like when I'm home by myself in the privacy, I've got the music on and I'm dancing and I feel great. And I've got clothes now that fit me. But when I walk out the door, they imagine what other people are thinking. And some of that's projection, but some of it very well could be true.
Right. I hadn't, speaking of thin privilege, which I acknowledge, I'm also operating from that position. And I realize more and more every day, because I honestly hadn't given the experience of fat people much thought until I met Mary. Honestly, it was like, I made all the same assumptions that, people who aren't enlightened on this subject make. And but there are things I think about, like that I've learned through interacting with Mary. Like, I think it was, I don't remember who, some friend of ours, maybe it was our friend Tess, who was talking about, being apprehensive about eating in public. And I was like, why would you be apprehensive about eating in public? And Mary told me, as a fat person, like you often will feel like you don't want people to see you eating. It's humiliating. Or like, you don't want them to like, they're, cause they're looking in your grocery cart. They're looking at what you order. They're looking at what's on your plate in a way that that has never taken up any bandwidth in my brain.
It never occurred to you. Yeah.
Right. And there's, I can't remember this person's name. I wish I could. She started that group Unlikely Hikers.
Oh yeah.
And she's a fat activist. And she posted one time something I've been thinking about ever since, where she said, like, I often wonder what kind of things I would have been able to do and accomplish if I hadn't been trying to lose weight, if my brain had not been so occupied by thinking about my body.
Yeah. I just did an Instagram post today about that. Like, I don't remember the exact words, but it was that question, like, what would you be able to accomplish if that energy spent on dieting and weight loss was freed up? Yeah. Right. Yeah. It takes up so much mental energy.
It's so true. And in your, I should mention, you have the body positivity card deck, and then you have the Making Peace with Food card deck. And I have used both, both those tools in my workshop. And there's one prompt you have that that says, you know, what kind of things are you putting off, you know, until you achieve some sort of body goal, you know, like, and, you know, if that's swimming, you know, what would it take for you to go swimming? What would it take for you to find a suit that fits or to find a place that feels safe?
Right.
Right. Because we want people to live fully in the world. And that, that exercise, like, you know, if I were thinner, I would. And so some of the things like you mentioned are swimming. Like I did a workshop once. There was a woman who loved swimming and she hadn't gone in 30 years. Oh. She didn't have a bathing suit. Right. So sad. So sometimes it's about, you know, supporting people or supporting yourself in taking that leap of faith. And, you know, you don't have to go, get a bathing suit and go to like, you know, there's certain places, certain swimming pools where people might be more concerned with how they look versus like a YWCA or, you know, you can think about where do I feel the safe? Where can I feel the safest?
Yeah.
Sometimes when people answer that question, they, it's a much more general answer. Like if I were thinner, I'd be happy or I'd be confident or I'd, you know what? And so this one gets a little bit more psychological where there are things that people, I want to say women in particular are taught to like translate emotional issues to their body. Like, you know, you're having trouble with this, just lose weight. Then you'll feel better and be able to do it.
Right.
And so the body gets burdened with all kinds of stuff that's, that are really core issues. And if that person loses the weight, you know, let's say you have somebody who has like, you know, a friend who has social anxiety. Mm-hmm. And if I lose weight, then I can go to the party. If you have social anxiety, it's not easier to go to a party. You really need to deal with the social anxiety. So I do a lot of work too with helping people unhook what are more core issues from blaming the body.
Yeah, because one phenomenon I've noticed when Mary will post, you know, sometimes you have these beautiful posts where you'll post a photo of your belly or, you know, a photo where you're standing in front of the mirror and you're, you know, wearing just a bra or something. And people will inevitably say, and I've noticed this now that I'm attuned to it, like I've seen they do with a lot of fat women, they'll be like, oh, you look so amazing. I wish I could do it. I wish I had your confidence. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little confused by those responses. It's like I don't, and maybe this is just my own sort of blind spot, but it's hard for me to imagine. Like, my hope would be that they would feel like empowered to, you know, like, oh shit, somebody else is doing that. I want to do it myself. But I'm wondering where must that come from? Like, what else might probably be going on where it's like, it's okay for Mary to do that, but I'm not as good as Mary. I can't do that. Or I couldn't have Mary's confidence for whatever, like what else might be going on there?
It's so funny you bring that up. I was just talking to somebody today who's a very similar size as me. And we had a session together and she goes, well, you have a really cute belly. You have a flat belly. I was like, I don't have a flat belly. She goes, well, mine has a little divot in it. And so I can't, that's really scary for me because my belly is ugly. And I said, what? But I mean, that's the conditioning.
Right.
Yeah. What do you think, Judith?
Well, I have a couple of different thoughts. So I'll probably lose some along the way, but in one way, Mary, what you're doing is really brave because you are making yourself vulnerable. We do have an anti-fat culture here. Mm-hmm. And I know you get so much love when you post, which is awesome because you have such a great following. I don't know if you get trolls at all. People certainly can and do.
Yeah.
And so you have to have a lot of courage. Yeah. You do have to have a lot of strength and support, mm-hmm. right, to be able to do what you do.
Yeah.
And you're provide, like, in doing it, though, you're making the world safer for other people. Yes. You're making it better. But the other thing I want to say is that, you know, I used to do when I was doing workshops, every so often I would do this like exercise where people had to write down what they said to themselves about their bodies in the past 24 hours. Right. Mm-hmm. And then after they were done, you know, I'd have like a whiteboard and we'd write up all the responses. You know, people would call them out and, you know, I don't want to say them because they're triggering, but you can imagine all the body hating, body shaming responses. And I'd read them back. And there would be this like palpable silence in the room, this depressed feeling, right? Like it felt horrible. Yeah. And inevitably somebody would say, I don't see you that way. Mm. You shouldn't say those things to yourself. Mm. And I just think it's, you know, we're all primed. We're taught to do that at a very young age, to criticize our bodies, to be embarrassed of bodies. You know, going back to what you asked around parents, what can they do? Well, one thing they can do is have books or expose kids to different size bodies and normalize it. That a belly is a normal, like women have bellies and they have dimples sometimes or divots or whatever you called it, you know, and they come in different colors and some are able-bodied and some are not able-bodied, like all the things we would want to start to know, like, you know, what you were saying, why it's just kind of, how do you normalize it? There's just all these different ways to have a body.
Yeah. When my brother was very little, my brother Rex, who's a physician now, he was, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4. And I remember we were out in our backyard by the pool and my mom had a bathing suit on and Rex grabbed her thigh and said, "Oh, mommy, your thigh feels like jello," like this, and kind of shook it. And she was like, "What? That is so mean. Aww. Don't say that."
See, that's, had
a really judgmental response to it. And looking back on it, I'm like, oh, that was another little piece. That's another little, and just me witnessing that and overhearing it, I was like, it's bad for somebody's thighs to feel or look like, that's what women's thighs, they kind of do. I mean, that's okay.
Right. So her own shame. So when Rex, 3 or 4, with no concept of body shame, just makes a comment instead of her, you know, imagine if she had said, "Yeah, it's so nice and soft. Doesn't that feel cozy?" You know, right. What a different kind of response. But her own shame comes up and her being angry. It's mean to talk about people. It's mean to say anything. Fat is bad. Yeah. It's taught so well.
Another, right. Just, this will be a shorter story, I promise. But I remember when my other brother Ford was real little as well, we were at the TCBY getting frozen yogurt. And there was this man who was fat sitting at a booth. And my brother Ford walked up to him and just with this sense of real wonder said, "Mom, look," he was wearing a blue shirt and said, "Mom, look, that blue kid is bigger than me. He's really big." And of course she ran over, "Don't say that. What's the matter with you?" Yeah. You know, like, that's so mean. You can't, but I was like, he was bigger. I mean, a lot, you know, people, adults are bigger than kids and he was a big guy. But again, I think, I didn't perceive that as being something that helps to shape somebody's view, but, you know, and you mentioned this earlier, Judith, like just the sheer volume of messages, I suppose it's inevitable that kids are going to be, and in that way, maybe it's not realistic to shield them from those kind of messages, but you can at least not perpetuate them, as you say, within your own home, and you can equip them to interrupt it, or at least not to internalize it as much, you know, if they encounter it out in the world, right?
Your story reminds me of when I told you that I learned from the two therapists in New York, Jane Hirschman and Carol Munter. And I remember Jane telling a story of having a friend, a fat friend. I don't know, they were out somewhere and a little kid ran up and said, "Mommy, she's so fat." And the friend said, "You're right, I am fat and I have brown hair and I'm a teacher," whatever it was, and just sort of normalized. They didn't have that response. Yeah.
Right.
Totally. I think it's also just so, to your point about shame, I think for me, this is, I think, why I've ended up in this place where wanting to have these discussions and wanting to talk more about weight stigma is because I feel like my work has been just really centered around shame and what that does to the body and the kind of stressors that, like, it puts you under. And I realized around when I was 20 that I was I felt like I had a rock in my stomach at all times, and I was just so tense. I was either sucking in all the time or wearing shapewear or concerned about what people thought of me. It was just so constant, and the amount of shame just felt so, like, it just felt insurmountable. I didn't know there was another way to exist or to feel comfortable. And a few of those, like, first initial steps for me, I hadn't realized as being very helpful as, like, or being related to the work that I do now. But when I stopped wearing shapewear and I stopped wearing high heels and I stopped I stopped shaving my armpits. Mm-hmm. And it was like all of these things that I felt that were almost like they were compulsory for me to do.
They were required. Yeah.
But once I thought about how they really made me feel, I was like, that doesn't feel good. Like shapewear right. kind of sucks. Like it doesn't make me feel good. And who am I doing it for? You know, and like wearing high heels, like they're really pretty, but they hurt. Mm. And like, this sucks. And like, why am I shaving my armpits? It hurts when I do it. It sucks. Like all of these things just felt so like I had.
Well, also, I have that realization how arbitrary they are. Like who gets to decide these things?
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of the intersection of like, you know, where, you know, feminism and like queer theory too, I think of just like, you know, in so many ways, especially like queer fat people are considered like the most failing. They have most failed at like being a civilized person, you know. Yeah. And it's, I mean, like to be able to unlearn that and to not feel internalized shame from it is really, really difficult to do.
Yeah.
And I think when we were talking about, you know, people commenting on photos like that, what I think about is when you are trained to see things through a lens of shame, other people's relationship or like joy with their body doesn't necessarily bring you joy. It just amplifies that level of shame for you where you're like, well, I've failed. Like I'm, you know, I feel ashamed of my body because I don't fit in. I'm not considered beautiful or healthy or whatever. And I don't love myself.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. like, and I'm not embracing myself. And I think that's sort of, you know, what I kind of want to ask you about is how do you feel about the, you know, the people who tend to be, who are, I think, rightfully critical about the dogmatic way that we view body positivity, that like you have to be able to love your body, you know?
That's a big question with a lot of different views. Only because the last week I was part of what was called the Body Image Summit, and it was sponsored by an organization I do a lot of training of therapists for. One of our speakers was Sonia Renee Taylor, who wrote Your Body is Not an And she was amazing as always. And so she talked about like, she doesn't love the term body neutrality because she doesn't think there's anything neutral about bodies. Like, you know, we need to reject body hate out there, and body love, you know, is a radical act that should be embraced. Somebody else on the panel I did at the end was like, yeah, I really like the term body neutrality. And this was a non-binary person who was just talking about like when there's so much body hatred, just as a therapist, getting somebody to neutral is a really big deal. So I don't want to be dogmatic about it either. I use body positivity in the card deck because that's the most common word out there. Mm-hmm. And we really emphasize in the card deck that it does not mean loving your body 24/7. It really means like, when the negative stuff comes up, when the shame comes up, developing strategies and skills to respond to it so that you don't keep internalizing it, so that you reject it. And it's, you know, with body positivity, unfortunately, there's ways it's been co-opted, especially on Instagram, to mean, you know, white cis women who are a little bigger than the norm. And it's not that we don't want body positivity for them, but it's just not broad enough. We need it to embrace all bodies, all body sizes. Mm-hmm. So I always, when I talk about it, I just talk about being aware of all the other terms that get used: body neutrality, body love, body confidence, body trust, body liberation, body justice. There's a lot.
Yeah.
And there's not a right way to do this. I think everybody has to kind of find like what speaks to them. Where's their comfort level? Because I don't. Yeah. So I'm not sure if that's exactly what you were asking, but that's at least part of it.
Yeah, I just, what I notice with a lot of my participants, it's like there's a level of shame they feel because they don't know how to love themselves. And so like loving themselves feels so unattainable that it only...
I do have another response for that. I think the best place for you to go with them is to talk about self-compassion. Mm-hmm. Like having compassion for why they can't love themselves. So instead of feeling shame about... Now still having shame. I'm in this class with Mary. I'm supposed to love my body and I don't. What's the matter with me? I'm failing one more time. To be able to say, of course it's hard. I have compassion for why it is so difficult. Me, I want to get there, but I can't, at least for now.
Right.
Totally. And I need to give myself space. I can keep exposing myself, like making sure my social media doesn't have all the weight loss stuff, that it's only more of the body positivity. Mm-hmm. I can sign up for Mary's class again. I can read the books recommended in the card decks. And, you know, but it's, I mean, what I always will tell my clients, this is the harder part of the work. It's much easier for me to help people make peace with food than with their bodies.
Right.
It's just hard. It's just hard.
Absolutely.
So I think self-compassion is the way to go on that.
I really appreciate that. I think it's really helpful.
I think the other part that is just so difficult is that everybody talks about health, including their own, usually their own doctors. And I know, Mary, I saw that you're doing your project of trying to collect fat-friendly doctors, which is awesome, you know. But if you, you know, even if somebody's going to the doctor and they're already feeling shame about their body, and then the doctor is saying, yeah, if you don't lose weight, you know, in instance, you've caused this condition. It's your fault.
Right.
It is hard to let go of that unless you're familiar with health at every size and all the other options out there, other ways to think about health and finding, you know, size-friendly doctors. It's, you know, people will have family members hassling them, and I say hassling, but a lot of times family members, because they're entrenched in diet culture too, they want their family member to be healthy, are saying you have to lose weight to be healthy. I don't care how you look, but I want you to be healthy.
Right.
And it takes a lot of practice to know how to respond to that.
Totally. Yeah. And I think also, I think what people forget too, is this work is so gradual. And like, you know, like it occurred to me like just recently, I was like, oh, it's really difficult to switch your values. Like, you know, for so long, if you've been in the pursuit of thinness, it's not just something you've done. It's something that you've deeply believed. Mm. And so to sort of challenge people's relationships to their values or desires is difficult, mm-hmm. I imagine.
But that's an interesting one because, you know, if you think of the pursuit of thinness, like what's beneath that? Like what's the value beneath the pursuit?
Right.
Mm.
Like what somebody, like maybe somebody values connection and they think the only way to have a strong relationship is to lose weight. So right. I think actually that's a really good thing to explore with somebody is, what are the actual values that you have? Like, what are the most important things? Or somebody values health and they think the only way to achieve health is to lose weight,
right.
Versus, oh, I could look at increasing some physical activity. The weather's nice. I could go for more walks. That will, that's a healthful behavior regardless of whether I lose weight. So
right.
I think it's important to dig a little deeper on that one.
Yeah. I agree. I think before I even knew about the term body neutral or body neutrality, I started, I mean, especially with like not shaving my armpits anymore and like not wearing high heels, I started calling it aesthetic indifference, to where I was like, how can I refocus about what these behaviors make me feel? And like, that was sort of the first work that I did, but I'm not joking. Like, Judith, it was only about 2 weeks ago where I had this huge epiphany where I realized in my fantasy dream world, when I used to think about my, you know, going to an award show or like, you know, having kids or what that looked like, in my fantasy world, I was in a thinner body. I was smaller than I was. And that continued as I've done all of this work until 2 weeks ago, where I was like, just like dreaming about an award show. And I was like, oh my God, in my fantasy, I am the body. I have the body that I have right now. And what I try to tell people is that this work takes it is a really gradual process.
Yeah. Right. And I think, you know, that, I mean, it gets cliche, but it's not about a destination. It's the journey, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's no place where you're finished and you've arrived.
Yeah. Right.
because you're in diet culture, like who knows what might, even for all the work you've done and the epiphanies you've had, who knows what's going to be triggering a month or two from now.
Right. Yeah. I feel that way about sobriety, where I'm like, it's not like I quit drinking and it's, you know, it's now that era of my life is done and I never have to think about it again. Like it's a continuous sort of process of, you know, of thinking about it and kind of reassessing my relationship with it. And I feel like that's also why I feel like it's been so helpful for me to have, you know, like go through the process of having grace enough for myself to say like, I don't have to promise that I'm never going to drink again and that, you know, if I do, I'm a huge failure. I can just say, like, this is what's working for me today. Like, mm-hmm. this feels good for me today. I don't need to do anything different, you know?
Yeah.
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 I think about that too. Oh.
Please, Judith.
I think about that with, like, you know, when I treat people with binge eating too, it doesn't have to mean you'll never binge again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it means that the binges are further apart. You get out of them more quickly, but more importantly, kind of, I think what you're saying too, like if, you know, if you're moving along and you haven't had a binge in a long time and then you do, it's an opportunity to figure out what's going on. Is there something I need to pay attention to? I had a client who used to call these AFOs, another fucking opportunity.
I love that. Oh, great. Here it is.
An AFO.
Another fucking opportunity. Yeah.
There you go. And there's some really interesting research by a guy named Eric Stice where he took, I think they were teens, and one group was restrictors or dieters and the other were the non-dieters. And they showed them pictures of highly palatable foods, so foods that are high in sugar and fat. The brains of the restrictors lit up differently. And it makes sense because if you think of our ancestors way, way back in times of feast and famine, in times of famine, your brain better light up so you're attracted to food so you stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think talking about food and addiction is helpful. And in my experience, anybody who's come to me and said, I'm addicted to food, once they've learned about attuned or intuitive eating and they've started to bring in the food, the binging goes way down.
Mm-hmm. Totally. One of the things that I experienced when I started doing intuitive eating was I didn't realize that I was, I may have stopped physically restricting food, but I was still mentally restricting or still putting food in a morality category.
Yeah. I mean, the diet mindset, it's first of all, you're undoing years, decades maybe, of learning about foods are good and bad. And so that's part of it. And it's just sneaky. Diet culture is just sneaky. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're doing something that's supposed to be healthy and you don't realize that there's still like that diet mentality around it. But I think the other things that's really tricky for people is that sometimes they'll like quit dieting. But if you quit dieting and don't know what to replace it with, you're still kind of in this place of, I should eat this, I shouldn't eat that. So you really have to do that work of reconnecting to your internal cues for hunger and what will satisfy you. I call that making the match, eating what will really satisfy you in the moment.
Yeah, totally. I wanted before, because I know we're limited on time, but I was thinking about, I wanted to talk a little bit to the, about the Psychotherapy Networker article about weight stigma. And one of the first initial discussions we had was a question I had regarding, you know, sexual abuse and, you know, especially early childhood sexual abuse and what that does to the body. There's a sort of belief that therapists have perpetuated, especially with me and a lot of fat people I know, especially mostly fat women, that that pathologizing fatness is like we make ourselves fat because we want to be desexualized.
God.
And like when I first heard it, I didn't think it was absurd. And now I'm like, that is such a weird thing to say. That's a really weird concept.
It's so complicated. And it's funny because it came up between us, but I was already in the midst of writing this article. And it came out because some years ago, I'd been at a conference where a very well-known leader in the trauma field was talking, and somebody asked him about obesity, and he talked about how it's bad to fat shame, but then went on to give that message that you're giving, that staying at a higher weight is protective. And the thing about it is that it can be. I'm not saying it never is. There are some people where it is. But I think what you and I talked about is that there's something called the ACE scores, which are the adverse childhood experience scores that are helped. They're really important. They're helped to predict in kids who have a lot of trauma. It predicts future behavior. So like drug and alcohol use and unintended pregnancy, but it's said to predict obesity. Mm. And the person who started these scores, what happened is he was working in one of these medically supervised weight loss programs, like I talked about at the very beginning of the podcast today. And when the women gained the weight back quickly and he started learning more about their history, he discovered they had both had histories of sexual trauma. Mm. And so he concluded that the reason they gained the weight back so quickly was because of the trauma they experienced. That's what's so messed up. Because right. First of all, now I will give him this, that this was, I don't know, maybe in the 80s, well before the Me Too movement, well before people realized you could ask just about any woman out there if they've experienced sexual trauma, and a high percentage of all body sizes will say yes.
Right.
Not just fat women, but, you know. So, but also what's gotten missed, and this is just makes me crazy that it has not gotten corrected over time, is that he's having people go on a diet, right? And we know that upwards of 95% of people who go on a diet will gain it back. So when these people gain back the weight, biologically, they're programmed to do it. And it's getting blamed on the sexual trauma.
Right.
And what that does is it puts people at higher weights under this cloud of weight stigma all the time. You're fat because you haven't resolved your emotional trauma. Yeah, there are people at higher weights and lower weights who haven't had severe trauma, and there are people at higher and lower weights who have, right? But weight isn't an indicator. And somebody may have had trauma and maybe they were using food to soothe. Because I will say, it's not obesity. I know I go on a long time, but I did just write a feature article.
No, so oh my God, like, great.
But it may be that person who's had a lot of trauma in their life is turning to food to get through the distress. That's actually a really good adaptive strategy. If you're experiencing trauma and you need to soothe, food is actually a pretty good choice.
Right.
And you may gain weight as the result. Okay. But the things people tell you to do to lose it just guarantee you're going to gain more weight. And so it's just this vicious cycle. So when I wrote the article the first time, I used a client example, they wanted more. And Mary, after we had talked, you had made that, I think you posted it on Instagram and I'd asked you if I could use it. And so I love that it made it, they were thrilled to have your quote.
That was so cool.
And I love that it made it into the article. Yeah.
Me too.
So
I remember when I was quitting smoking, there were so many people who would, I followed this subreddit that was Stop Smoking, which was such a helpful tool for me while I was quitting. It's just, you know, just people asking for support, giving updates, asking questions, all of that. And there were so many people who would say, I want to quit smoking. You know, I have all these negative, you know, health effects of smoking and I really need to quit, but I really don't want, is what's always stopped me is I don't want to gain weight. And of course, people would comment and say, like, holy shit, quit smoking. Like, who cares if you gain weight? Yeah. Everybody would say, like, you might gain weight, you might not. But if you do, you quit smoking. Like, it's okay if you.
The power. Yeah, but that's the power of the culture and of fat phobia, that I'd rather be thin and risk dying of lung cancer than gain a few pound weight back.
What a sad indictment of how prevalent that kind of thinking has become.
Yeah.
I mean, when like you have the most obviously bad for you activity you can possibly do, like there's the evidence is just overwhelming.
Honestly. Oh, seriously.
That's powerful. Yeah. Like that's a powerful story. Like that's, I mean, we've been talking in this, I'm teaching this class about rhetorical criticism and we're doing critiques of like news coverage, news framing of issues. I'm having students kind of examine patterns of language, how issues get sort of framed rhetorically. And I had them look at this really good rhetorical analysis about, it was this woman who moved to Maine with her husband, who was a college professor, and they bought this house kind of close to the woods. And the woman was in her backyard and got killed in a hunting accident. A hunter shot her accidentally.
Oh, no.
And the news coverage, the article analyzes the news coverage that blamed her for getting shot by saying this was an outsider who didn't know that if you're in the woods in Maine, you have to wear blaze orange. Like, what's wrong with you? You didn't know that? And it was talking about how this guy got acquitted over and over again by these Native Mainers who had their traditions and had their culture and had this sort of resentment of outsiders and, you know, couldn't accept that this hunter was responsible. And the jury would have this evidence right in front of them. Like the prosecutors would say there were no deer even in that area that he could have seen. Cause he said he thought he saw a deer, and the jury was like, no, he did. He's part of our community. He wouldn't lie. Of course he saw them, even in the face of evidence that absolutely disproved it. And so we talked about how powerful it is once you sort of choose a way of thinking about something, even if you have direct evidence that contradicts it, the story, your desire to maintain that narrative is so powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on a much simpler or basic level, the earth is flat, the earth is round, you know?
Right.
And I use this when I do my trainings. You know, there's a lot of evidence that comes from the CDC, right, Center for Disease Control. Catherine Flagel did a study showing that people who fall into the overweight category for BMI actually live the longest. I mean, if you're looking at mortality rates, it's people in that category. And then people who are, I won't go further with it, but it confirmed over 40 other studies. And so there, a bunch of summers ago, two of those studies came out. One was from Japan and one was from Canada. And I happened to be watching CNN and there was a doctor saying, reporting on these two studies. The interview was basically over. And at the very end, like as a throwaway line, she said, but it's probably still a good idea to lose some weight.
Oh.
So, and I think that's what you're talking about. It's just, right?
Right. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a formal term for that. Yeah.
Yeah, you really do. It's like you get to a point where that narrative is just so endemic to the way that you see the world that it would shake up your whole worldview. And what could you trust? Like, if I can't trust that losing weight is the only thing you should do if you're fat, what else can I not trust? You know, it's like my
think about, like, if, you know, in my 30s, 40s, 50s, I come to that realization that I've spent all my life trying to achieve this. As a result, I weigh more than I would have if I had never started. I've spent all this money. There's a lot of loss.
Yes.
And there's really like a grieving process that people, I think, need to go through.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yes. Big time.
I just really, like, I don't want you to go. This has just been such a fabulous conversation. We're just so lucky to have had you here.
I'm like, okay, what, like, I want to, like, let's leave on a hopeful note, you know? Like, I'm just thinking, I'm like, how has the world, I mean, because I will say, I think that fat phobia has gotten more deeply entrenched and ingrained in our culture. But I also think that there are, like, there's also a really robust sort of counter argument that I think is gaining traction too. Yeah, I'm just curious, how do we find hope? Help us, Judith.
Oh my gosh, how many people are following you? You put that thing out asking for medical doctors.
Yes.
That's such a great response. I published that article and I think it had over 12,000 hits in a very short time. I mean, we're just
y'all are all doing our thing.
Again, it's probably that cliche, but, you know, you're the pebble that creates the ripples, the change that makes the change.
Yeah.
Right. And so we're all throwing those pebbles and we're rippling. And this podcast is part of that too, I hope.
Yeah, me too.
Yep.
Thank you, Judith, so much for your time.
Yes,
and
thank you
for having me, Wyatt. I'm so glad to meet you.
I'm so glad to have met you too, Judith, and your wisdom and insight and your just graciousness has been such a pleasure to talk to you. It's almost like you talk to people for a living.
Yeah.
You think?
Very suspicious.
Thank goodness I'm okay at it.
Okay, and where can people find you?
Yes, and we'll post links.
Oh, okay, thanks. Instagram at Jude Matz, JudMatz. And my website is judithmatz.com. But please check out, you've mentioned the Body Positivity card deck and the Making Peace with Food card deck. I have the Diet Survivor's Handbook and Beyond a Shadow of a Diet. We didn't talk about the kids book when we were talking about what parents can do, but there's also a book for children that kind of captures some of this. So just Google me, you'll find me.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Judith.
Thank you, Judith. It's a pleasure.
Thanks to both of you.
Wow, what a convo.
It's like the best.
What a great conversation. And now it's time for something not so great,
which is our segment. I came up with this idea, and I am so curious to know what you... Did I mention I came up with it?
Yes.
And I'm so curious to know what you have prepared for this. But we're doing another top five list, which I think is, like, our laziest segment, but that's okay.
Yes and no. But I think the things where we have to think really hard about... You know, I just think it's not as easy as one might think, you know?
I put a lot of thought into mine.
I did too.
So we're doing the top five best sounds and the top five, I guess, bottom five worst sounds.
Yeah. Yes.
What should we start with? Best or worst?
Let's start with worst.
Worst sounds? Okay.
And then bring it up, you know?
Okay, do you want to alternate?
Yes.
Okay, what's your first worst?
The first worst thing was turnips high pitched.
That's what I put too.
Is that your first thing?
I wrote the high pitched whining sound turnip makes.
Yeah, it was a mix between the high pitched whine and like her growl. Growl at Georgie.
But the high pitched whine is like, and there's no indication of like what she needs or why she's doing it. I'm sure listeners of our podcast have heard it before.
Oh, you all know it.
It's ear splitting. It's a disgusting, inexcusable sound.
Sometimes she'll just make that sound like in the middle of the night when she decides that it's like too dark.
Yeah.
I swear to God, that's why she's crying. She's like, it's too dark.
Yeah, she's like, I don't like it.
I don't know how to jump on the bed. It's too dark. Can't see.
She'll just sit at the end of the bed just making that noise for 10 or 15 minutes. Very charming. what's your next worst sound?
Okay, this is very specific, but it's like pop music that has been EQ'd too harshly, where the high frequencies are like up so high that they hurt my ears.
And the song sounds kind of sharp or something.
Yeah, it's like very...
like not sharp as in flat and sharp, like abrasive or something.
Yes, exactly. Like, and especially like my hearing is so sensitive that like anything that has a bunch of air in it, like I think that's sort of what we would call air in the engineering world is like, it's just, it almost sounds like like whistling or like, whistling or like breath up top. It's just, I like a little bit of it, but too much really just
grates on the world, grates on the nerves, grates on the brain.
Yes.
I really appreciate that. You know, you've given me such insight into awful sounds. my next worst sound, I hate to say this because I do love them, but it's just that screeching sound that any corvid makes. Especially blue jays. They're really loud and really obnoxious. But at the same time, when I hear one, I get really excited because I just love them.
I did not know that was a bad sound for you.
I'm not crazy about it. I think also they're so insistent. Yeah. You know, like there's nothing dulcet or pleasant about what sounds corvids make.
It's true. Yep.
But I've got other birds on my best list. Don't worry.
I hate the sound of babies crying. Not like it gets on my nerves, but just like it makes me
sad.
It makes me sick.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how we're ever going to be parents.
It used to make me feel really depressed.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why. It used to make me feel like really, like, also just the face of like a kid who's been like screaming in the grocery store, God. Like just red and like, you have no idea what they're trying to tell you. As I always say, though, it's hard to be little.
Yeah, it really is.
It's hard.
Like, that's the thing with like dogs and babies is like, they can't communicate. Like, if someone that's older, like a younger kid, you know, that's not quite a baby, can communicate at least a little bit about what they're upset about.
Right, but for a little baby or a little kid.
No, I feel it makes me feel helpless.
I completely agree. My next, this also makes me feel helpless. My worst sound is the sound of a metal eyelet, or what I've learned is an aglet is the name of the sheath that's at the end of a drawstring, like when it's metal and when it clanks against the walls of the dryer.
Whoa.
Like when there's something clicking as especially it doesn't happen at regular intervals. Mm-hmm. So it's like, and there's something about like, I know a lot of people think that when there's a noise that happens at regular intervals, it's more obnoxious, like Chinese water torture type thing. Do you feel that way?
Like when things happen at regular intervals?
Like if there's, let's say there's like a beeping or a squeaking sound, what is worse to you? If it's like in a regular rhythm or if it's irregular?
Ooh, it really depends on the sound.
Really?
Yeah, if I can make it musical in my head, like if it's, really? If it's a beep, I can make it, I can turn it into a song in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's irregular, that makes me really upset.
Really? Yeah. Like when the mini split makes that clicking noise. Also, if anybody knows what the fuck is causing that, if you could just reach out, leave sound off in the comments below.
Help.
It's not at regular intervals, and it's worse to me.
Okay, that's my next least favorite.
Is what
is the sound of the mini?
Is it really? Yeah. Do you have it written down?
No, but I just decided.
You included it.
Yeah.
Next, mine is the sound of anything being wrong with your car. Like, when you can hear, like the belt squealing or anything, and then you're just like, fuck, this is going to cost $800.
Yes.
Much like vet bills, it's always $800.
Yes. That was my next thing.
Really?
The sound a car makes when the engine won't turn over.
Oh, my God.
It's the worst feeling. You're like, oh, my God.
It really is. Or that sound.
Yes.
That's awful. Okay, what's your next one?
That was it.
My next one is motorcycles or any kind of like a high-pitched car when it's somebody who's like clearly driving too fast, like on purpose, just to be obnoxious. Yeah, especially if you're eating outside or sitting outside and it like interrupts your conversation and you have to like wait until they've gone by.
Totally. Okay, my next other thing is like motorcycle groups.
Oh,
When
I was living in Fayetteville, they did this. There's this thing called Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue every year that was like, I feel like they always exaggerated the number of people who were there. They would always be like, there were 400,000 bikers here this weekend. It was like never that many, but it was enough that it was like horrible. And of course, their culture is all like, it was like I would take pictures when I'd be walking behind them, like on the way to class or something, of like the patches they'd have on their vests, and it would always be like something fucking disgusting.
Like God's guns and
it'd be like, I love pussy, get on the back of my motorcycle. Like, don't fuck with the Confederate Army, you slut. Do you know what I mean? It was awful. I hated it. There were a lot of people who just leave town when it happened. And then in Austin, this is chaotic. I don't know if it's still this way, but it used to be that every June, Pride would happen on the same weekend as the Republic of Texas motorcycle rally.
Oh, no.
And the only cool thing that came out of that was, like, the Dykes on Bikes crossover. Which is fucking cool.
That's like in high school they had Bible study and GSA at the same time.
That's not right.
You had to choose sides.
Yeah,
I choose the right side. Yes. I choose the gay side.
Yeah, you're like I'm actually louder than y'all, and I'm redirecting all of your prayers to Satan. Okay, what about the five best sounds? What's your number one best sound?
One of my favorite sounds is the sound of handbells at Christmas time.
Oh, like, yes.
I just love handbells. I think they're one of the most beautiful, like, it makes me feel nostalgic.
It's very evocative. Yeah. I really like that one.
What about you?
Mine, so I'm going like in reverse. I'm going 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Is cracking open any can of a carbonated beverage.
Yeah.
It makes me thirsty. It makes me happy. Especially, I like it when people do, like, when they're trying to be quiet, so they kind of the first part slowly and then at the end. I just think it's really, I just love that sound. And what about your next one?
Okay. You know when ice is just like a really thin sheet on top of dirt, and it's not slippery or anything, but you just kind of get to crunch in.
Yes.
It's like very satisfying to crunch.
My second, I'll just reveal it now. My number two was snow, specifically under boots, like crunching under boots.
Yes.
And also crispy leaves crunching under boots. But did you encounter that at the park today?
I mean, it was like, it was a high.
That icy wonderland?
Yes, I loved it.
You gotta love it. My number four is the little chirp of a cardinal.
Oh, that is so cute.
Like, that's not an offensive sound, especially because you could always see them because they're so bright, and especially love it when you can see a male cardinal and a female cardinal nearby, like, chirping at each other. Also, the coo, this was a tie, the coo of a mourning dove. And, you know, I think they're monogamous because there's a little pair that I see. They hang out, like, when I come home, I can see them on the tree right in front of where I park my car, and they just sit on the little branches together, like, preening and like, just nuzzling each other. It's so sweet.
So cute.
And I love their...
I love that.
And what's your next one?
One of my favorite sounds is, like, the sound of, like... like muscles in a bowl, like muscles,
yeah.
Like how like the
that
muscles,
kind of hollow,
yeah, of eaten muscle shells or clams or something. But
yes.
Like, I just love the way they kind of tinkle against the bowl.
I just paused so that I could go and get this. This has to be one of my favorites. It's this little instrument you got in Peru.
Yes.
What's the name of this?
I've always called them goat nails. I don't know what they are. Like, they're, it's one of my favorite...
Whatever it is, it's falling apart. Sorry.
I know. They're, it's one of my favorite sounds. I used to go to this open mic, and this guy had that kind of sound around his ankle, and he was like a one-man band.
Cool. So
I just love the way it sounded.
And ooh, I love that.
I put this, actually, this sound in Seasonal Depression, that song.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Ooh, I love that. It just reminds, you talked about muscles in the bowl. That's what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
My next one is clothes tumbling in the dryer. Like, as long as there's nothing clicking or clanking irregularly, you gotta love that sound.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just so relaxing.
That's so real for you.
I was like,
I can't, I'm not gonna agree.
Validate me. Okay, you don't like that sound.
It's not that I don't like it. I just feel indifferent about
it. You feel indifferent.
Yeah. Well, but I do get a sense of, like, something is being... It makes me feel like I'm doing things.
It's comforting.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I get that.
Yes.
So this is going to be very specific to my experience. There is really nothing like hearing, like, thousands of people chant your name. And, like, it's, like, applause is great, but, like, when I used to tour with Macklemore... So I toured with Ben for, like, 2 years.
Yeah.
And he did this thing just specifically after I sang. So also, like, I would tour to sing one song. So
yeah.
And I would spend the whole day just, like, doing nothing and, like, put on a fancy dress and then go out and just, like, get a ton of applause for doing,
that's
like,
so good.
For singing, like, for 3 minutes.
That's a dream. It's kind of, I mean, that's a dream gig, right?
But I remember, like, every time I would end, Ben would make everybody, I don't know if he made them chant, but he would just make everybody, like cheer for a long time, and then everybody would start chanting Mary.
Oh my god!
I mean, one time I forget what festival we were at or what it was, but it was like 20,000 people, and they were all chanting Mary.
Oh my god!
And I'm like, this should not happen to people. Like, this creates.
That's how the dictators are born. Yeah. Like, military dictatorships.
I'm like, I have to be really careful. This can get to your head.
That's fucking awesome. Well, my number one favorite sound is the sound of your voice singing.
My top one is your voice.
Really? That was the Macklemore one was your top one.
No, it wasn't.
Time's up. My last one. Was it? Did you really say
that? Yeah, your voice.
Did you type that while I was in the other room getting your stupid instrument? Because you looked over and saw that you were my number one?
I didn't see that.
If any of you have any information about this incident. No, I'm just kidding. That's so sweet.
I love your voice.
Who are you talking about?
You?
This was a really sweet. I really like this little segment.
Me too.
Didn't you?
Sweet.
Is it time to move on to obsessions?
Yes.
Okay, let's move on to obsessions.
Okay, tell me what you're obsessed with.
You already know my first one. Your eyes got big. First of all, also, Mary scared the shit out of me when I was in the bathtub reading earlier.
Oh my god, I felt so bad.
I had the water running, so I didn't hear her coming up the stairs. And at the second I turned the water off... And what did you say?
I was gonna say Papa was a rolling stone, and I was like really excited to just like come in there and belt it at you,
and like I was so startled I like splashed around and like I'm sure my eyes looked terrible.
You looked panicked. You looked like I was a murderer, and I felt like I was a murderer.
That was amazing. But no, my number one obsession above all else has been since I read Team of Rivals actually. Has been the fucking American Civil War. I have been, like, I'm obsessed. It's all I can think about. I think about it all day, every day. I am taking a little bit of a break right now, but I'm listening to, like, old episodes of book TV on C-SPAN about, like, Reconstruction. Or, like,
that's
about,
my baby,
like, the Battle of Manassas or, like, the Battle of Appomattox, like... I know everything. Like, I'm reaching the point where I feel like I know everything about the American Civil War.
That's amazing.
I know, like, the major generals. I know the major battles. I know the turning points. I know. I read a fucking biography of Jefferson Davis, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Who sucks, by the way. And sucks more than you ever thought he sucked. And his biographer, I think I talked about this in the last episode of the podcast.
I read the books, like the biographer kind of liked him and like kept saying all this weird shit about like, we don't really know Jefferson Davis's perspective about black people. I'm like, yes, you do. What?
This isn't like, we don't have to, this isn't going to be a nuanced conversation.
No, but one of the things, so one of the things that Civil War historians talk about is the Cornerstone speech. So that was, and it's just like the perfect comeback for anybody who pulls this lost cause bullshit about like the Civil War was about states' rights or whatever. Yeah. The Cornerstone speech was the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, who is like, looks like a character out of a fucking horror movie, by the way. Oh my God,
show me.
He gave this speech in which he said, the white supremacy is the cornerstone of our government is the idea that black people are inferior to white men. Like, it's like, absolutely undeniable. But so anyway, this is Alexander Stevens.
Oh, God. Oh, man.
Right? Not good, right?
Oh, shit.
Yeah, no. But so anyway, I am, like, watching every documentary. I'm watching Ken Burns, like, million-part Civil War. Like, I am absolutely hooked. I am hooked. I can't be, there's no drug as powerful as the American Civil War. I'm addicted. I was looking at, like, battlefield, like, historic sites. I want to go on a historic tour. Like, I'm obsessed. Nothing will ever compare to me, to this for me. Sorry.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah, you have been saying, like, I want to go here. I want to go see these Civil War sites. And I've just never... I remember, actually, I swear to God, a year ago, you were like, people who are obsessed with the Civil War are too kinky.
It was... I thought so, too, but now I'm one of the kinks. Like, I was, like, watching, like, a tour of the Gettysburg battlefield, like, given by some weirdo civil interpreter. Like, anyway, yeah, Steven said, our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea, saying that the Union stood for the equality of the races, right? Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition.
Oh my God.
This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth.
Jesus.
I think it's really hard to make any argument about, like, oh, it wasn't, the Southerners loved black people. It was just like their way of life. I'm like, what the fuck? This is the vice president of your stupid little fever dream.
Wow. Anyway. Okay, so this guy was the vice president of the Confederacy?
Yeah, Alexander Stevens. Don't start me on this, honey. I will talk for six hours. But
one... Who was the Secretary of the Treasury?
Dumbledore. Who was... Did you know Dumbledore is a Confederate general?
He did wear a pointy hat.
Oh, also, this is my other favorite thing I learned from, he did wear a pointy hat. So many little one-liners, like, I'll listen back to the podcast and be like, fuck, I didn't even hear her say that, because I was, like, preparing my next brilliant thing. But, Andrew Johnson was Lincoln's second vice president, and Johnson was just like a piece of shit, a horrible person, a virulent racist, the reason that Reconstruction fell apart. I mean, one of the huge reasons, he sucked, right? And he was like a populist. A lot of people compare him to Trump. Mm-hmm. But so anyway, the best thing I've read about him is that he showed up to Lincoln's second inauguration just totally fucking wasted. And that, like, everybody was like, what is this? Like, he was just so drunk he could barely talk.
Oh, my God.
And that he was like, I just want to thank the cabinet and President Lincoln. He was like, and who's the Secretary of the Navy again? Like, in the middle of his speech.
Sorry, isn't that I think cool? That's funny.
And the Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, was the one with the fabulous beard and, like, the pretty long hair.
Oh, I like him.
I like him, too.
I like his really pretty hair.
Yeah, Lincoln called him his Poseidon.
Aw.
Oh, wait, no. Sorry, his Neptune.
Aw.
Aw. Okay, that's it. I have to stop right there. But so that's the big,
main obsession.
I'm intoxicated. If any Civil War buffs who happen to be listening, I'm beginning my slow descent into, like, being an old, like, middle-aged man, like, wearing khaki shorts and, like, going to battlefields. Like, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, while my, like, kids are annoyed and, like, just want to get back in the car and go home. And stopping at every historical marker.
We're going to do that.
I'm ready. I'm ready for that life.
Well, similarly, my first obsession is about Love is Blind.
That show, when you do the cheesecloth for me, y'all know that Mary will just like condense these episodes down to just a highlight reel, mm-hmm. and it is intoxicating.
I pick like the most compelling storylines, and then I walk you through it almost like a PowerPoint presentation. Like,
yeah.
Like, I give myself like 20 minutes to give you like this summary of like 5 episodes.
Yes.
You know, like the most important details. Anyway, I feel like I don't want to give any spoilers because I feel like people are still watching it.
People are getting caught up.
But I just have so many feelings about it. And like, I need to join a group. Like, I need to join
I bet there are Patreon supporters who watch it. Maybe you should do a little Love is Blind discussion.
That's a really good idea. We should have a reality TV roundup.
Oh my God, this can be a way. I will be like, hey, any Patreon supporters want to come and like talk about the Battle of Antietam? Like, or you want
to. We're not doing your thing right now.
No,
my
but
thing.
Like, maybe they could come if they want to talk about like, what was James Longstreet's role at Gettysburg? Was he really the reason that was a Union victory? They could come and talk about it.
You're obsessed and you're sick.
I feel honestly like I've met like basically a new lover that I'm gonna... Stop. Did you like that?
Yes.
Okay, so anyway, Love is Blind.
Yeah, anyway, I'm obsessed with it and I feel like there's so much I want to talk about with it, but I feel like I just can't. But there's just what can I really say? Like I don't want to spoil anything. Because the reunion show just came out, like, yesterday, I think.
Oh, so it just ended.
Yeah, it literally just ended.
Oh,
there's
shit.
We haven't, there's
we haven't
so
recording.
Much. Yes, we have. I can see it right in front of me.
You're a fool. You're a fool, and I love you.
My last and second obsession is that I'm reading David McCullough's book about the building of the Panama Canal.
What?
That was my second obsession? Yeah. So I felt, because I was like, oh, I need to, like, wean myself off of the Civil War. How do I do that? And this shit all with the Panama Canal all happened, like, in the 1870s. This goes back to Beverly Hills, the Real Housewives of New York City, though.
Yes.
Because Ferdinand de Lesseps.
Uh-huh.
Any of y'all out there might know Countess Luanne de Lesseps. Talk related. About. And he, who turned out, was a French guy who just really fucked up the first attempt at building the Panama Canal. And it was his fault that, like, 20,000 people died and, like, they all got yellow fever. But Teddy Roosevelt is going to fix everything now.
History is sick.
All right.
You know what I'm saying?
Okay. All right. Very good.
How many men there are
who forget to hold the door when I give them so much more than they can imagine.
Good job.
You do such a good Luann. Do you have any more obsessions?
Yes, I have two more. Not similarly to your to your relationship to the Civil War, but I feel like for the same amount of time that you've invested yourself in reading about the history of the Civil War, I have been invested in my finding weight neutral practitioner work.
Yes. Oh, so yeah. Yeah. You've dived in.
I'm obsessed. It's like kind of all I can do, all I want to do right now.
Yeah.
Especially after, like, about 2 weeks ago, I was working on a demo for a TV show, a project they were, you know, wanted me to try something out, so.
Which is super exciting.
Which was really exciting, and then I also did an audition for, I was given, I don't know if I talked about this on the last episode.
I don't think you did!
But, like, I got an audition for this new animated movie, and I signed an NDA about it, so I can't really say anything about it, but, the role was, I was like, oh, this will be great. I'll audition. And then I, like, read the fine print. And I was like, the role is with a Cockney accent.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I've never done a Cockney accent before.
But
like,
you, I mean, I don't really have a basis by which to judge it, but I think it sounds fucking great.
Thank you.
You want to take it for a spin? No.
I just need to, like, I need to be able to read something.
Okay.
Like, let me read that. We're delighted to announce that we created a new position for Tamra Day. Like most organizations, we're absolutely desperate for new staff, so we're willing to do just about anything. Anything?
Jolly good, then.
No.
Excellent job,
no,
then,
I hate it.
Well, too bad. It's staying on. I think it's fucking great. Also, I just asked you, like, cold out of nowhere, do a Cockney accent.
I'm all red.
You're red. It's so cute. Honey, you did great.
I just want it to be very good.
I love you. You did great.
Thank you, honey. So, anyway, I'm like, this is all to say, I have been really excited to get back into doing my body work.
Yes.
And so, like, working on the weight neutral practitioner list has been just really... Oh, it just made me feel really good. I'm up to like 700 providers, like finding care practitioners for people that are at least, I mean, like, and this is also kind of embarrassing because it's like these doctors that are recommended, like for the most part are like one, they didn't fat shame one person one time. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like kind of the bar is pretty much on the floor.
Right.
For fat people not getting, you know,
adequate healthcare.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but hopefully this will be like a really helpful resource, and I'm hoping to have it up by next week. And I was able to like source a lot of different you know, people and like other people who have sort of started this work and have their own directories and databases. And
you're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And so I'm just really, really excited about it. And
hell yeah, baby. I'm really proud of you for just really plunging in.
Thank you, honey.
I think you're doing an incredible service that I'm just really proud of you.
Thank you. And I think too, there's, I don't know if y'all experience this, but it's really difficult to let go of like binary thinking in a lot of ways. And so I'll just be super real with you guys. I had I kind of messed up. I was sort of pulling these directories just online, but as free resources and not really thinking about like, you know, the people that curated them or the people that put together this work and that like that might affect them.
Right.
And that might feel like, hey, you didn't even ask me, you know, like I was just kind of pulling these free resources and seeing them as like, I'm entitled to them. Of course I am. And of course everybody knows my intention and that it's pure. And this is like, I'm not going to be like, this isn't going to be behind a paywall. Like, I want this to be accessible to everybody.
Right.
And like, in my position, I was just like, well, everybody's going on. This is about accessibility. So like, why would anybody be against that?
Right.
And I think the more that, you know, I thought about it was like, oh shit, it's not that, you know, these creators or people that made these lists wouldn't be against it. It's just like, hey, let me know. Like, just like,
ask me. Let me know what you're doing. Right.
Yeah, give me an opportunity to consent or be a part of it, you know?
I think that people are really going to appreciate you sharing that. I think there's not a single person who has not, you know, sort of inadvertently stepped on toes that way.
Yeah.
And the way that you handled it was really impressive to me.
Thank you.
I know that you still feel kind of bad about it. You have some lingering feelings about it. But I think that you did what anybody could expect you to do.
Thank you, honey.
Which is repair.
Yeah, I'm trying. I think like that's what I deal with the most is like as I'm talking about binary thinking, it's like either I'm doing the best thing for the world and I'm so amazing, or like
yesterday,
I'm the worst person in the world. I'm like an absolute garbage person and I shouldn't be doing this at all. And this is like, I'm hurting people, you know, like I was just like sobbing yesterday, feeling like so bad about like
my poor baby.
Like I just felt awful. I was like, oh my God, like how entitled and presumptuous of me, you know, and like I'm glad I worked through that. But it was just it's really difficult. And I think the element of also being bipolar is like, yes, a lot of people deal with that. But I think people with mental illness like take it to a full another extreme.
Yeah.
So I've had to learn to like not full out like go down a really scary, you know, thought pattern.
Yes.
Like in that I've had to sort of self-soothe myself through it.
Yeah.
Self-soothe through it.
Yeah, no, yeah. I get it.
Yeah.
And honey, I just say I think it's fabulous that you're talking about it. I think that that's like that kind of vulnerability and transparency is going to be really useful for people to hear.
Thank you, honey. And the last very quick thing is we are building a basement studio for
It's
me.
Actually happening.
It's happening, yeah.
After a year.
Delay?
Yeah. Oh my God, it's so exciting and so loud.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's very cool. It's very cool.
And it's very cool.
I'm obsessed with the basement.
So I'm so excited. Like, As I heard the noise all day, I was like, I wonder what it's going to look like. It just sounds. I don't know what the fuck they're doing.
And they're hammering and sawing.
And bang, bang, bang.
Yeah,
you know?
Lots of banging.
Yeah, just like our bedroom. Oh, my God. No. No. Actually, yes. Okay. Do you want to read your poem?
Yes.
Wait. Is yours... What's the temperature of yours mood-wise?
Like, thoughtful and sad.
So is mine.
Okay.
We'll just yeah. have a thoughtful and sad off.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, please.
I am reading a poem. We have read so much of him on the pod, Reginald Dwayne Betts.
I love him.
He wrote this beautiful poem called White Peonies.
Ooh, I would love to hear it. I love him.
And I found this because Kamon Felix, one of my favorite writers, friends,
just people
posted this, and I just thought it was so beautiful. White Peonies by Reginald Dwayne Betts. This is how it happens. One morning, the ground is only the ground, and then green shoots through the rich brown loam. I learned the word loam when I was starving for something.
Mm.
Fools would call it love. And I would say it was a time machine, longing for some days, months, years, when the regrets didn't bloom like this thing from the ground that I can barely name. Tell me how these peonies have migrated from Asia to my garden, have found their way into my line of vision, despite prison and all the suffering I don't speak of. It all happens so sudden is what I mean to say. When sadness, because of beauty before your eyes so startling, you ask friends what to name this flower before you. I admit, I've pretended to be God, to give a name to this thing that gives me joy. I called it Sunday, and then called it after my firstborn.
Mm.
Have you ever been so startled with the unexpected? That you wanted someone's blessing to name the thing.
Mm.
The peonies are so beautiful, they frighten me.
Mm.
They grow on thin stems that are longer than my arms, and the blooms are heavier than the stems. But isn't it always so? The beauty of the world so heavy we fear the world cannot stand it. And yet, why would we not want to pray when we notice?
Mm.
Why do we forget that naming is the first kind of prayer, even as the white flowers turn into scented oil against my skin?
Ooh, God, I love that naming is the first kind of prayer.
I know.
God, that's so good. Ooh, that's beautiful. Thank you. They're so beautiful, they frighten me.
Yes, I admit.
That poem is so beautiful, it frightens me.
I admit I've pretended to be a god.
Ugh.
Okay, tell
beautiful.
Me what you got.
I have a real classic.
Okay.
I have, because as part of my detox from the Civil War, I'm planning to read the biography of Sylvia Plath that's called Red Comet that my mom got me for my birthday, Christmas, something, a few years ago.
Yeah, Christmas 2 years
ago. A huge, like, 1,000-page biography of Sylvia Plath. So I wanted to read one of her poems.
Oh, my God.
It's one of my favorites.
Which one?
It's called Elm.
Okay.
And it is for Ruth Fainlight, Sylvia writes. I know the bottom, she says. I know it with my great taproot. It is what you fear. I do not fear it. I have been there. Is it the sea you hear in me, its dissatisfactions, or the voice of nothing that was your madness? Mm. Love is a shadow, how you lie and cry after it. Mm. Listen, these are its hooves. It has gone off like a horse. All night I shall gallop thus impetuously till your head is a stone, your pillow a little turf, echoing, echoing. Or shall I bring you the sound of poisons? This is rain now, this big hush. And this is the fruit of it, tin white like arsenic. I have suffered the atrocity of sunsets. Scorched to the root, my red filaments burn and stand, a hand of wires. Now I break up in pieces that fly about like clubs. A wind of such violence will tolerate no bystanding. I must shriek. The moon also is merciless. She would drag me cruelly, being barren. Her radiance scathes me. Or perhaps I have caught her. I let her go. I let her go, diminished and flat as after radical surgery. How your bad dreams possess and endow me. I am inhabited by a cry. Nightly it flaps out, looking with its hooks for something to love. I am terrified by this dark thing that sleeps in me. All day I feel its soft, feathery turnings, its malignity. Clouds pass and disperse. Are those the faces of love, those pale irretrievables? Mm. Is it for such I agitate my heart? I am incapable of more knowledge. What is this, this face, so murderous in its strangle of branches? Mm. Its snaky acids hiss. Mm. It petrifies the will. These are the isolate, slow faults that kill, that kill, that kill.
Jeez. Oh my God.
Isn't that so good?
I mean, don't you just, when you read her, don't you just like get it? You're like, she gets it.
Oh my God, yes.
She feels it. She gets it.
Anybody with mental illness, like any, you know, woman who's experienced mental illness or depression. Like, I think that's why it's almost like a cliche for, yeah, like, you know, sort of like moody teenagers to read Sylvia Plath is, yeah, because I'm feeling this really,
really
big. Yes.
Move, mama.
Groove, mama.
We should have read that one.
Damn it. Yeah, you're right. That is what I remember.
It was a poem.
Was it? Hello, Gross.
Hi, Gross.
Hi, Gross. Oh, we still need to watch that Next Altar live.
We do.
She did a live. It was supposed to be lunch.
Lunch ladies.
At Euphoria, at the high school in Euphoria. Okay, everybody.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye.